Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, Joe Biden's running around the country, and he's given a tour, and he's touting, the touting tour, Bidenomics. And he's saying everything is so great. Oh, look at what all I did in terms of jobs and inflation and wages and so on and so forth. You know, well, last week we talked about Bidenomics in relationship to neoliberalism. Remember that? Yeah. I want to sort of drill down and address Bidenomics more specifically here. And debunk his tour and what he's saying on the tour. It's important for people to know that just because he says it doesn't mean it is. So first part of the show here, I want to talk about Bidenomics and the tour. And what's the facts about job creation and wage growth and inflation and GDP even? What are the facts of Bidenomics? You know, politicians tell you whatever they want you to hear when they're running for office, and then when they're elected, they do what the hell they want, which is usually what the moneybags who finance their campaign want. They talk the talk, and then after the election, they walk in a different direction. So you can't take as truth here what these people are telling you during the election. And Americans fall for it, you know. They really believe. They're gullible. You know, it's a accepted characteristic to be gullible, I guess, you know. But most are gullible about, well, they said they're going to do this. Well, you know, look at the track record historically. Did they do what they said they were going to do? No. Okay, so let's talk about Biden's tour and Bidenomics. You know, he's running around, he's talking. I think he's in Pennsylvania yesterday or today, you know, and he's saying that, I created 13 million jobs and the unemployment rate is down to 4%. Oh, wages are rising. Oh, inflation is down to a third of what it was. Okay, let's take these three areas and then talk about the economy in general and debunk them. Okay, what can we say about jobs? Well, first of all, 13 million jobs, he didn't create those jobs. Those aren't net new jobs, most of them. Those are people who return to work slowly after COVID. Yeah, that's what those 13 million jobs are, people returning to work. That's not a creating. The job was there. And the economy shut down, and now they're returning to work. He didn't create anything. Also, you got to remember that U.S. job statistics aren't contiguous with workers. The U.S. measures jobs. It doesn't measure people returning to work. Employment, well, employment and jobs, the definitions are pretty much the same. And you can have someone who's taken on a second and third job, part-time job, and that's job growth, right? But it's the same worker. There's no worker growth. There's no employed person growth. There's job growth. Of course, you know, people are returning to work, so that's an employment growth as well. But they're not exactly the same meaning. Okay. He says 4% unemployment. Well, as I've said many times on this show, that 4% number is for full-time jobs. What about the 50, 60 million part-time temp gig jobs? Well, they're not measured in that 4%. What about the 10 million people who are independent contractors? In other words, they are not incorporated. They're non-incorporated. You know, a lot of people get laid off and they become freelancers. You know, they become individual proprietors. They don't have anybody working for them. Well, aren't those workers? Yeah. Oh, but they don't count them in the unemployment figures in the labor force. You know, for a while they did. When we had COVID, they added those people for the first time ever to the eligibility for unemployment benefits. So they did recognize that these are workers, right? 10 million of them, independent contractors, unincorporated independent contractors out there, not part of the unemployment calculations. Treat them as businesses, not as workers, you see. So the 4% unemployment rate is bogus. It's only full-time, permanent, non-freelance, non-independent contractor workers. If you add the 50 million part-time temp gig workers and another 10 million independent contractors, unincorporated, right? And you added that to the unemployment calculations, your unemployment calculation would be probably around 8%. Even the government statistics add some part-time temp workers and those who have dropped out of the labor force. You know, that's another thing. If you dropped out of labor force, you're not unemployed. You may not have a job, but you're not unemployed. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? Yeah. Well, anyway, you know, 4% unemployment rate is just a segment of the total workforce. Doesn't include part-time, doesn't include independent contractors, doesn't include people who dropped out. And even the government, Labor Department, includes some of the part-time and temp and dropouts. And that's called the U-6 unemployment estimate. And that's, I think that's already, that's still 7%, 6.5, 7% still. Even their own government figures say 6.5, 7%. Oh, but the mainstream media and Joe run around saying 4%, 4%. A lot of the workers, these 13 million who have come back, have also come back to lower paid jobs, part-time jobs, right, at lower pay. We've been churning out full-time jobs and replacing them with part-time for at least a couple of decades now. And that process accelerates in recovery from recession. So you got to understand that 13 million isn't really new created, and 4% is not really the true unemployment rate. And we're leaving off 50, 60 million out of the calculation. So, okay, that's the reality about jobs versus Biden's spin. What about wages? Well, he's claiming wage increases 4%. People are getting 4% on average, and that's more than the inflation rate. So the real wages are rising, not what's wrong with that claim? Well, first of all, the 4% is an average across 160 million plus people in the labor force, not counting the independent contractors or considered business. Okay, 160 million average. Now, it's not equal 4% across all the income groups. You see, that 4% is skewed towards the top and to some extent at the very bottom. In other words, the top 10% of the labor force, maybe even 5%, are getting much more than 4% increases in their wages. And that drags up the average to 4%. Who are these people getting more? Well, they're mostly supervisors, managers, CEOs. You know, they make a salary too. And professionals. Industries that tend to be booming, like tech and defense, right? They're paying their workers more than 4%. And then you get the average of 4%. When people in the middle, the median working class may not be getting any wages increases at all. And to some extent, at the very bottom of this whole picture we call the wage structure, at the very bottom of the wage structure, you're getting some boost as well. I don't know, maybe 15, 20 states have raised the abysmal minimum wage. About 60% of the states haven't changed anything from 7.25%. $7.25 an hour minimum federal wage, which buys less than the three in real terms than the $3.50 during the 1960s. That bought in real terms that bought you more than the $7.25 today. Minimum wage in terms of its purchasability has been going down for the last, well, at least four decades, maybe more. So, yeah, some increases at the bottom. You know, maybe there's maybe, 20 million people at the minimum wage level and that level just above that, because when minimum wages go up, the level right above it, right just above minimum wage, gets a boost too. So you got a little bit of a wage boost going on at the bottom and a significant wage boost going on at the top of the wage structure, and that gives you your 4%, which means the people in the middle aren't getting very much, if anything, at all. That's the fact about wages. And in real terms, with this significant inflation we've had, 21, 22, and now to 23, real wages have been going down. By the way, they've been going down for two decades at least, real wages. When inflation goes up, real wages really go down. They drift down anyway, even when you don't have inflation, but inflation accelerates the real wage. In other words, what you can actually purchase with your wage, that goes down. How are workers dealing with it? Well, the way they're dealing with it is credit. Credit cards are at a record level. Use of credit cards. People are using credit cards to supplement their insufficient wage adjustments. I've read even this new phenomenon, people are using the credit cards to pay their rent. We'll talk about rents shortly. So credit card usage, right? Taking on second and third jobs, that's another way. And by the way, that's how you get all these these job numbers increases, because the government doesn't care when it calculates unemployment where it's a part-time or a full-time job. It just simply says, okay, a job's a job, even if it's 10 hours a week. Oh, whoa, we're going to add that job to the total jobs created. Okay, for purposes of calculating unemployment, in other words. Okay, so what we've got is real wages are biased by the gains at the top and lesser extent at the very bottom. And for Joe to run around saying, oh, 4% increase, you know, you look under the covers and for most people it's not 4% if it's anything. Just as the unemployment rate is probably double, actually, what the 4% number he keeps throwing around. And he didn't create any jobs. These are returning jobs. Okay. What about inflation? Oh, he's bragging now on his tour that, oh, we've cut inflation from 9% to 3%. Consumer Price Index, latest. Yeah. Okay, you got to peel that onion too to see really what's going on. Yeah, last summer it was 9%, and the latest June figure for CPI, all items, both goods and services, 3%. But look behind that 3% number, and what do you see? Well, food is still 5.7%, almost double the 3%. Food is double the 3%. And that's during harvest when fruits and vegetables go down. And by the way, that 5.7% is overweighted because of dairy and eggs, which were zooming in price, have abated, have come down sharply. Well, that brings the food index down even more. So, but still, it's 5.7%, double. What about rents? Look, lodging, shelter, and food are the two biggest expenses for households. After that, it's probably gasoline, transport. What's rents? Well, rents are 7.8% officially. We know it's higher than that. We know it's higher than 7.8, but 8%, you know, that's almost triple the 3% overall item, all items. And we know 7.8% is lower because of the way the government calculates rent. As I said, I think it was last week, it includes 50 million homeowners paying themselves rent. Can you believe that? And that, when you add 50 million to your denominator, of course, it dampens the whole number. 50 million renters in this U.S. about 50 million homeowners. You know, give or take several million each way. Well, when you double the number, quote, in rents, because this figure is for shelter, the 7.8% is for shelter, which includes owner's equivalent rent. So, bottom line, you know, food is still double the 3%, and rent is almost triple. And those are the biggest items. The index is composed of goods and services. Goods, meaning discrete things that you buy that last a long time, durable goods, or stuff that you buy and consume, you know, like gasoline, that's non-durable goods. And then there's services, which is the big number. Services, 80% of the economy. Well, services are rising last month. Yeah, 6.2%, double the 3% average. 6.2% versus the previous month, May, 5.3%. So services prices in general are going up. Food is still double the all-item average. Rents are almost triple the all-item average. And on top of that, we see energy prices, which are largely responsible for the coming down of the CPI since last summer, they're going back up. OPEC is cutting supply and crude prices are rising. Grains, in other words, corn, wheat, and so forth. Well, now the grain deal fell apart in the Ukraine, so speculators are going to drive up grain prices, commodity prices. So food prices are going to, baked good prices are going to go up, right? Residential home prices in the U.S. are rising again, and corporate price gouging is continuing. Does that look like they've got inflation under control? I don't think so. Yeah, there's been some success. Good prices have come down because the global economy is slowing. How much is that goods prices due to slowing of the global economy and versus the Fed rate hikes? How much? Well, there's no analysis of that. But I think a lot of the commodity prices have come down because of slowing down of the global economy. Commodity prices, you know, being energy prices, oil, natural gas, etc., grains, wheat, corn, barley, whatever, right? And then metals, you know, whether you're talking about metals, iron ore, copper ore, aluminum, whatever. Those prices have all come down as a result of the slowing economy. And, of course, that gets passed on into import prices to the U.S., which have come down significantly. So how much of the CPI has come down because of import prices and slowing global economy is a question. I think it's at least half of the slowdown in energy and commodity prices, goods prices, is due to slowing global economy, and only half maybe due to Fed rate hikes. You see, because if you're an international, global, multinational corporation, you don't care what the Fed does to interest rates because you don't borrow based upon what the Fed rate is. You either have so much internal funds that you self-finance your expansion, you don't care what the Fed rate is, or you go somewhere else in the world and you use another currency to invest and expand. There's money markets all over the world, and you can, currency markets, you can go buy whatever you need as a global company. So Fed rates don't have that much effect anymore in a global capitalist world that's become globalized. And sources of finance are everywhere in the world, not just U.S. banks influenced by the Federal Reserve. One of the reasons why monetary policy is not as effective and efficient as it used to be. It may cause a local company that does business locally, it's not global, it's not international, right? And it does borrow from banks, commercial industrial loans, in other words, your local food chain or construction company or something like that. Yeah, the Fed rates will affect them. But, you know, Disney doesn't give a damn about it. And, General Motors doesn't give a damn about it. They're global. They get their money wherever they want. Or if they're a tech company, they're so flush with cash, they don't have to borrow anything. I mean, even 2 years ago, Apple was sitting on $250 billion of cash. Yeah. So, you know, inflation has come down a little because of goods and slowing global economy and to some extent rate hikes. But it's over-influenced by a few items that have come down a lot. Now, consumers don't just buy the few items that have come down that bring the average down. They buy food and they pay for lodging, and that's still double and triple what the official 3% rate is for all items. And as I said, there are forces brewing that are going to start pushing up crude prices and oil prices and energy prices and commodities, grains, and metal prices, and home residential mortgages and home prices. All these things are forces building that are going to start bleeding into the economy in the second half. I don't think they're going to get inflation down much more. But, you know, you can play games by looking at these broad general averages. 3% inflation. Well, you know you're not paying 3% when you go to the grocery store, you know, or you pay your rent. You know that. But that's what they say. That's what Biden's running around saying, because the government... See, the problem with government statistics is not that they're wrong necessarily, although sometimes they are. The problem with statistics is that you can cherry pick whatever you want and give it whatever spin you want. You know, Biden's out there spending 4% unemployment, 3% inflation, and I just gave you an alternative explanation based on government data as well that they don't bother to cite that shows quite the opposite. Inflation has come down some. Global economy and goods inflation. Goods prices are flat. They're not rising. Goods, 20% of the economy. Goods, what? Manufactured things and construction. That's goods. It's not services. Services are 80% of the economy, as I said, right? And some of them are really going through the roof. Car repairs, 12.7%. Car insurance, 17%. Inflation. Right? Baked goods, 9%. Right? Food, certain foods, up big, but you know, prices come down because of the way they measure them. Last week I talked about, I'm not going to go over it again, the three, just three of the many ways they manipulate inflation, you know, owner's equivalent rent, using different base base period indexes, right? Lowering actual prices due to quality changes, you know, in electronics mostly, right? There's a lot of things that, you know, chain pricing and so forth. A lot of ways that they manipulate the inflation. It's not that they make false numbers. They just make certain assumptions, which reduce the price increases that they report. Same thing with wages, same thing with jobs, right? Okay, so, you know, Biden's claims of 13 million jobs and, oh, wages are 4%, inflation is only 3%. When you look behind the cover here, it's quite a different story. And what about GDP itself, the economy? You know, he thinks the economy is doing so good. Well, as I said last week, last year the economy grew 1%. Net, December to December, December 2021 to December 22, 1%. The Fed is forecasting a 1% this year. After we spent $8 trillion stimulus, fiscal and monetary stimulus, we get a 1% growth rate. Wow, that's worse than the recovery, growth rate recovery after the 2008-09 recession under Obama. That's worse. Every crisis we have in recovery, it's weaker and weaker. Well, that shows you there's something wrong with the general economy. Look, they just came out a couple days ago with this statistic, not by the government, but by an independent source that's been reporting economic data for over a century now, called the Conference Board, right? Conference Board. The Conference Board produces the statistic which it calls leading economic indicators. I think there's like 15 leading economic indicators saying which way is the economy going. These are economic indicators that tend to move early before an actual recovery or recession, right? Leading economic indicators. Okay, they just came out last week and said the leading economic indicators contracted again 15 consecutive months now. 15, and they are accelerating. Leading economic index still contracts, and the contraction is accelerating. Oh, but they're talking about soft landing. You see, Janet Yellen gets out there, says, oh, well, you know, we're not going to have a recession. We're going to have a soft landing. Well, they're probably going to cherry pick whatever statistic they need in order to substantiate that claim. But the reality, I think, will be, I mean, look, you know, 15 months of contraction and accelerating contraction, either those numbers are totally worthless, which they haven't been in the past. I don't know why they all of a sudden it would be worthless, which means the recession. I think we've been in a recession, certainly a goods recession, and some service sectors. But are those statistics absolutely wrong that we've been using for a century? Well, also another statistic, which is called the yield curve. When short-term rates, interest rates, Fed rates are higher than long-term, that kind of signals a recession as well. That's predicted every recession out of the last 10, I think. Well, that's been inverted for some time. That's a leading indicator. So, what does that mean? That mean we're going to have a soft landing? I don't think so. But Biden's running around saying we are. He's running around saying soft landing, we won't have a recession. He's saying inflation is down 2/3. He's saying wages are up. And Jobs, 13 million. And, you know, the media just promotes this. You know, it's an echo chamber. Mainstream media is an echo chamber for the politicians. They just report. I mean, how many times have you read in the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or Washington Post the alternative unemployment rate to the 4.4%? They always report the 4% full-time workers only, which have been in decline long-term. And they avoid the 50, 60 million other workers who aren't full-time permanent. Yeah, they ignore them. You won't see that statistic, even though it's a government statistic, you know. Just look at the government employment situation report when it comes out every month, you know. Just go down, I think it's table 13, B13, you know, and it'll give you the unemployment rate, not just for full-time workers, but for part-time, temp, and discouraged workers, those who drop out of the labor force. And even that's an underestimation because it doesn't include all those independent contractors. Okay. Well, that's the Biden tour touting the economy that's supposed to be doing so great. But when you look under the covers, it's not so great. Whether you're looking at jobs or wages or inflation or GDP and the economy or whatever. Okay, that's my addendum to Bidenomics. I'll be writing something summarizing what I've just said here over the weekend. And just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can read what I've just said. Okay. I want to move on now and talk about labor, union labor, which is dear to my heart, having been in younger days in the labor movement at least 15 years, working for four different unions as an organizer and a local elected president and vice president and contract negotiator and strike coordinator and so forth, you know, from the bottom up. It's always been dear to my heart, and it's pained me to see over the last four decades, labor in undergoing what I call the Great Detour. Yeah, the Great Detour. Look, most people aren't aware that union labor in the early 70s, went through a period of magnificent gains in wages and benefits. Magnificent. Well, what? The biggest strike wave in this country occurred in 1970-71. The second biggest was in 1946, after the war. But the biggest was in 70-71. And during that period, led first by construction workers, teamsters, then auto workers and steel workers and dock workers and so forth, across the board, industrial labor, negotiated major contract deals, which in those years were no more than 3 years, contract terms, 3 years, 25% increase in wages and benefits in the first year of a three-year contract. Think of that. Would you like a 25% raise, anybody? Well, if you were in one of those unions in the early 70s, you would have got a 25% raise. The corporations couldn't stop it. Labor was so powerful, they couldn't stop it. Labor had what's called national agreements, pattern bargaining. You know, they'd pick one company, whether U.S. Steel or General Motors or or something, and they would strike them and use that as the pattern. And these were nationwide contracts and even construction trades. These were regional contracts. You know, there was a construction trade contract for all of Northern California, and all the trades, you know, whether they were electricians or plumbers or cement and whatever, were all subject to this one contract. Well, that was power. And they exercised it. Because during the 60s, when they had a Democrat in the presidency and in Congress, the union leaders pulled their punches and they let inflation rise without wage increases. But once the Democrats left and Nixon was there, they unleashed their power and got these big increases. And ever since then, the employers, the capitalists, have been circling their wagons in the 70s and figuring out how to reverse all that. Well, the first thing they did is they got their buddy Richard Nixon to impose a wage freeze and to roll back the 25% to only 5.5% by law. A wage freeze followed by 2 years of wage controls. In other words, keeping all these contracts to 5.5% rather than the 25%. Yeah, and then the AFL-CIO went along with it. And then they had the big inflation of the first oil crisis in 73 to 74, and that took away, in real terms, a lot of the wage increases. And then they had the recession, 73, 75, that dampened further wage increases. So they rolled it back. And then more permanent, long-term, employers got together and figured out, you know, how are we going to prevent this from ever happening again? Well, in the construction trades, they began busting them first in the late 1970s by allowing non-union operations outside the major industrial urban centers. This is called double-breasted operations, you know, double-breasted two. Right, they ran those the home building in the suburbs. They ran that as non-union. They set up a parallel company, these construction companies, a non-union parallel company, and then they limited the right to strike at sites, and they undermined the construction trades that way. And then they broke up these large regional agreements, contracts. And that deflated the building trades, which were very powerful. And what did they do to the other industrial unions? Well, the way they dealt with the industrial unions was to get the government involved in negotiations on behalf of the employers. The key development was in 1979, the great Chrysler strike, UAW Chrysler strike. The government intervened and forced the union to begin giving up the gains that they had made for 40 years before that, since World War II. Concession bargaining, it was called. Yeah, and it worked. The union, once again, union leaders, Doug Fraser was president of UAW in that time, 79. Now you had a Democrat president in there again. You know, one of the big problems of labor going backwards, great detour, is that they allow themselves, the leaders at least, to be manipulated by Democrats. And Doug Fraser agreed to give up concessions, 79, because Carter, president then, wanted it. Because there was elections the next year, and he didn't want that to ruin his chances by undermining the economy. Story told many times, very similarly. Most recently, with the railroad strike potential here with Biden and Pelosi. You know, it's not new. It goes way back. That kind of a sucking up, leaders of labor sucking up to the Democrat Party, which gets them, oh, don't embarrass us. You know, we'll take care of you and after the election. And of course, they never do. Promise some labor law reform, but they never do. But the politicians get what they want in the meantime. All right, the concession bargaining begins with that great Chrysler strike in 79. And it continues, accelerates under Reagan and ever since. And under Reagan, we get the offshoring of these big industrial unions that just devastated them. You know, not only did they lose membership and jobs, you know, at one point, the UAW, Auto Workers Union, was like 2.1 million members. And they quickly shrunk to like 700,000. I think it's like 500,000 today. And a lot of that was offshoring. These companies, big multinational companies, just moved offshore. And with the help of the government, because the government gave them big tax cuts to move offshore. Yeah, move offshore, we'll give you tax cuts. Investment tax credit, that's what that was about. You know, workers paid their taxes so government can give some of their taxes to the corporations when they took their jobs away. Yeah, so union membership in these great industrial unions began to collapse in the 1980s on. The Great Detour was underway, in other words. They were never going to allow another 70-71 strike wave. Right. They, the government increased the power of union busters to break up unions. How did they deal with the transport workers, right? Transportation, which you couldn't offshore, right? Railroads and airlines and trucking and so forth. Well, they passed a series of laws that deregulated those industries that caused new competition to enter. New companies, which drove down wages. So you see, they had a strategy. They, the capitalists and their politicians, developed in the late 70s, early 80s, that dealt with the construction trades unions, as I described, with the industrial unions offshoring, as I described, and with the transport workers competition. Oh, and by the way, it wasn't just transport, it was communications. They deregulated and broke up the AT&T system as well. So a legal attack, a legal offensive, you might call it, and it decimated the unions, especially in the industrial unions, secondly the construction unions, and that continued for the next 40 years. And whenever the workers rose up and had some successes here and there, the government stepped in and helped the employers out in several ways. You know, I think it was in the 1990s, mid-1990s, we had the great harvester strike, and then there was the UPS strike, which was the result of a new leadership, Ron Kerry, in the Teamsters Union. Well, they did a trip on Ron Kerry when that was over. Boy, they went after him, the government and the corporations, and they got rid of him. Right. So it's key to make sure they have compliant people at the top of the unions who are more concerned about the Democrat Party getting reelected than they are about their own members oftentimes, right? Another way that the unions got undermined was the general shift to serviced employment. Services jobs grew as industrial and construction jobs shrunk since the 1980s. And it's much more difficult to organize and negotiate significant gains with services. Why? Because the bargaining units are smaller, right? They're not strategic. You can't shut down the country as you can with transport or big industries, right? They tend to be low-skilled, more turnover. Right, fixed capital. In other words, light manufacturing. During that period, I was a union president and negotiator and organizer. And I remember we organized my local organized all the waterbed companies in the Bay Area, all of them. Yeah, I mean these were very low paid immigrant workers. Really needed a union. And we organized them successfully, and we sat down to negotiate, and the companies, all of them moved to Nevada, and we couldn't stop them. How are we going to stop them? right? The laws were and the government and the courts were all in their favor. They could move, and because they had all they had to do was put their light machinery, you know, that was in their warehouse, to put it on a truck and move it to Reno. That's all he had to do, and they did it. And we couldn't force them. The union wasn't strong in Nevada, a right-to-work open shop state, right? Couldn't force them to, and the workers there were desperate for any kind of job. So, you know, all half dozen companies moved. Runaway shop. Yeah, that was another way that they dealt with it, undermining unions, right? But the shift to service employment, you know, there was jobs and services that are increasing, but it's hard to organize them. They're smaller. You don't have the leverage, and they're not strategic, and they're low-skilled, which means a lot of turnover, right? And fixed capital is low, so they could run away to a right-to-work state, which they did. Along with the shift to service employment was the growth of what's called precariat jobs. Precariat, precarious, right? Part-time, temp jobs, contingent jobs, gig jobs. These are all product of the last 40 years under neoliberalism. It didn't exist before. The unions, when they were strong, they would not allow part-time temp workers. Or a very small percent of part-time temp workers were allowed in under the contract. Well, when the unions got weak, they couldn't stop it, right? All this involuntary part-time work began to surge in the 80s under Reagan. That's when all that began to surge by millions, involuntary part-time, which the government and the NLRB ruled were outside the bargaining unit. The government could increase these part-timers and not include them in the bargaining unit. Well, that weakened you know, labor's negotiating ability, because if you went on strike, well, there's this big pool of part-timers that were outside the union. It was all conscious how they did that. Under Clinton in the 90s, we had this surge in addition of temporary workers. Part-time and temporary now became a big issue. And, of course, in the 2000s, we've had gig workers, which are kind of the latest iteration of part-time temp, right? Gig workers. So this has undermined labor, because the government says, oh, gig workers are business. They're not workers. They're small businesses, and you can't, by law, labor law, organize businesses. That's another way they undermined unions. So the shift to service employment and the shift to precariat jobs, 50, 60 million today, precariat jobs, are, you know, another way they undermine the ability of unions to reorganize and grow their ranks back after they were decimated. The government also has been a little bit of carrot, and in addition to its stick here, you know, workers organize, want unions when, you know, their economic situation deteriorates significantly. But as we created all these service jobs and part-time and service employment, the government cleverly sort of subsidized wages by low-cost imports, the Walmart effect, I call it, right? Most of the goods at Walmart come from elsewhere in the world, cheap labor. At one point, 85% of all Walmart's goods were made in China, by the way. So, you know, low-cost goods, if you can get T-shirts at $5 instead of $10, you know, you can survive, all things equal, with less of a wage increase, you see. And then credit of all kinds, you know, not just credit cards, but student credit, right, mortgage credit, installment credit, was another way of placating working class folks when they couldn't get wage increases because the unions were destroyed, right? And the legal offensive sort of aided concession bargaining by unions, right? Pattern bargaining was broken up, you know, this massive strike wave of the 70 based upon pattern bargaining, national and regional bargaining contracts. Well, those were all destroyed legally. The LRB, the agency that's supposed to regulate fairness and labor management relations, you know, became very pro-employer. And it got so bad that the unions were demanding, and after 2000, to have labor law reform to level the playing field. And Democrat candidates always promised it, but they never delivered, and they're still not doing it. You know, the PRO Act. Biden says he's pro labor and the PRO Act. Well, they won't even take it out of committee, even when they had a majority control of the House. They wouldn't even raise it out of committee to pass the PRO Act, you know, Labor Law Reform Act. The same thing under Obama, you know, the Card Check Act. They didn't even get out of committee, even when the Democrats have control of both houses of Congress. You know, they're not serious about that. Pattern bargaining, right? As labor got weaker, of course, it became more dependent, at least its leadership became more dependent on the Democrat Party, which is a kiss of death to union labor. But the leadership, you know, they get a few crumbs that they can then say, oh, look what I got from you and the Democrats gave us, therefore elect me again. But, you know, these elections, the workers themselves are getting tired of that. And you can see that in the changes in the leadership, you know, this upsurge in demanding leaders that, you know, are more in their interest than the Democratic Party interest. You know, like this guy, Sean O'Brien, now leading the Teamsters. You know, and he's told Biden and Democrats don't intervene in the UPS negotiations, by the way, which have restarted again on the 25th. The contract expires and the Teamsters on August 1st. We'll see what happens. A very important development, the Teamsters UPS negotiations and possible strike. We'll see what happens. You know, we thought maybe that, you know, last year's railroad labor negotiations would be the turning point in this great detour, but it turned out not to be. There was no way the Democrats were going to allow the railroad workers to strike. And they played, I think there are 9 railroad workers unions. They're based on different craft skills. You know, there's the machinists and there's conductors and there's, you know, engineers and so forth. That goes way back 19th century when they organized the railroad workers based on crafts. And the government played them off against each other, as they do. You know, you get a couple of them to buy into the Democrat proposal, no strike and so forth. About half of them were going to strike anyway until Pelosi and you know, Biden jumped in and said, oh, you guys got to strike. Well, anti-labor legislation, here it comes. No strike legislation. And then you get the other unions. Oh, they get so worried. Oh, you know, you settle because, you know, no strike will affect us as well. You know, so you get the labor's own trying to force a settlement. And it becomes overwhelming. Even leadership in those unions, railroad unions that wanted to strike, they couldn't. And what were they striking over? They were striking over paid sick leave. Yeah, they were tired of not being able, when they were sick or worn out, to take a day off. The railroad companies wouldn't let them. Even if you were sick, you couldn't take a day off. Why? Because coming out of COVID, the railroad's companies didn't hire everybody back. They didn't want to. They're saying, oh, they're not around. They didn't want to hire people back. They were running with a 70% workforce. That means those who have jobs working were working like hell, getting sick, getting injured, whatever, no time off, weekends and so forth. All they wanted was 7 days, 7 or 8 paid days. That's all they wanted. Whoa, that was too much for the railroad companies. Yeah, and so Biden and, of course, Pelosi came down on the side of the railroad companies and said, you guys strike, you know, anti-labor. They had it prepared. They had it written. Pelosi had it all written. It was just a quick vote here and no strike. Well, hell, there hasn't been a strike in the railroads in decades. You know, they're not going to let the railroad workers strike because too much power there, too much power. So all these strategies and tactics, you know, they dampen that strategic negotiation. But the workers almost broke through. Almost. But it's different with the Teamsters because you don't have all these different 9 different trades unions that can be manipulated against each other. You got one big union. Yeah. And they got to manipulate the new guy, Sean O'Brien, who just got elected, promising to change things. And I don't think in his biggest bargaining unit, 340,000 UPS workers, I don't think he's going to change. You know, and he's got to think long term about artificial intelligence and self-driving trucks. He's got to think about that, just as the SAG-AFTRA and writers are thinking about that now, because artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, is going to take their jobs away, and they know it. That's why they're out on strike. Well, the same thing down the road before 2030 is going to happen to truck drivers. There's 1 million truck drivers in this country, 1 million. And a lot of them are going to lose their jobs to self-driving trucks, which isn't here now, but it will be here in 5-6 years. And they know that. You know? And these companies want 5-6-year contracts now instead of 3 years, and the union's agreeing 5-6 years. Yeah. The other key negotiation that I lost track of was West Coast longshore workers. Their contract expired last summer, and they've been working without a contract, which is against their tradition, but they were working without a contract, and I understand they're taking a vote. Maybe they've already voted on a last offer by the employer. That, if it hasn't been ratified yet, that could blow up as well. Powerful transport union, you know, the ILWU, longshore workers, with a long tradition of militancy and one of the best contracts in the country, really. That thing may still erupt. Certainly the Teamsters situation is key. You got the SAG-AFTRA writers strike going on. You got the auto workers under a new leadership also beginning negotiations. So, you know, slowly here we may be having a confluence of forces on the labor side, which may end the Great Detour. I think the big issue for the Teamsters is this two-tier wages. The companies have hired people at a different rate and pay. Ironically, during COVID, to get truckers to take jobs, they actually paid new hires more than the contract for the existing truck drivers. In UPS. This is UPS I'm talking about. Yeah. The new hires have more, even though people with more seniority are getting paid less. Well, that really irks a union worker, no doubt. You know, this guy with no experience, and I've got several years' experience in the company, and he's making more than me. Nothing more to piss him off than that. And that's one of the big issues. Yeah. One of the big issues. Well, we'll see if that gets resolved. I think it will get resolved, but, you know, the company will try to resolve it, stretching it out as long as they can. In other words, we're not going to resolve it in the first year of contract. You know, we'll do it over 5 years, maybe. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. Okay, I'm out of here.